Greetings, and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast that has grown so tired of agreeing on the greatest game of all time that it needed something to argue about. Yes, we are taking a break from our Final Fantasy VII Rebirth covers to tackle controversy head-on, and that's to decide which of the two following platforms is slightly better than the other, the Super Nintendo or the original PlayStation. Taking up the mantle of defending Sony's honor is me, David Lloyd, and to no one's surprise, the man that will be defending the RPG genre on the Super Nintendo is this guy, Jordan Rudick.
I mean, things have just been too positive around here. It's just been a total love fest for RPGs, right? Like, whether it's love for Rebirth or love for Command & Conquer, we needed to spice things up a little bit. So I proposed we do kind of like it's a discussion-based podcast, but it's also like, you know, which one's better, right? Like this one or this one. And obviously, we have a lot of fondness for everything here, but yeah, let's have some combative discussion, some heated discussion, just for a little bit of a change.
Yeah, and like before we were discussing, like it's basically in the vein of you know, who's a better hockey player, Bobby Orr or Wayne Gretzky, or who's a better basketball player, LeBron James or Michael Jordan. No one's gonna say that they aren't the greatest of all time, but it's there has to be a number one and number two. So that's what we're going with here.
It's fun to be on one side of the debate or the other. And I think that this is a good one for sure, especially RPGs. Like if you grew up with both consoles, you probably have a lot of fondness for both, but maybe you lean one way or the other. Maybe you owned one. Maybe you just spent more time with one. Maybe the Super Nintendo was around during a point in your life when you were just either super into games or you really needed games as an escape or something like that. You know, you might have more nostalgia for one or the other, but we want to break down the lineup and just kind of see, kind of, you know, developer by developer, publisher by publisher, like what's really stands the test of time here.
Yep. Yeah, but before we get into that, I know for myself, and I'm sure there's others out there as well, we've been on the fence with Dragon's Dogma 2. We're seeing the discussions online. I'm seeing tons of weird tweets and or whatever they call them on Blue Sky these days, with talking about these funny things going on in Dragon's Dogma 2, whether it's the drones or what, I can't remember what they're called now, the team members that are dying,
the pawns, or
the pawns. That's it, pawns. The pawns
drones is a funny way to call them, actually, because they kind of are like drones.
Yeah, pawns getting into trouble, or viruses killing off characters or whatever. There it seems like there's a lot going on, but I still haven't made that plunge into purchasing it yet. So Jordan, I know you've finished up or wrapped up the first chapter, so why don't you tell us, how's your experience been? Is this still something worth getting, or how's it going for you?
Yeah, totally. So I think the first time I talked about the game, I was very, very early on, only played like an hour or so, really just kind of got my feet wet. I've played about, I think I'm in the kind of 12 to 15 hour range now. I've moved on from like the first kind of major area and kingdom, where there's lots of quests and lots of space to explore, and little kind of some side villages and outposts you get to see as well. And I've gone to, like, I guess, the southern part of the continent now. So the game doesn't divide itself into chapters, so I don't know how you would break it down, but I'm definitely in a new area that has like a new kind of environment, new biome. Things look different. There's different enemies, stuff like that. I'm still really digging the game. I still think it's very interesting. I'll start with a quick anecdote about the aforementioned pawns. In this new area that I'm in, I found that there's these rope bridges where you can take like a conveyance across like large chasm type things rotating a wheel on these platforms. And so you go across like one mountainous area to the next one. It's not a huge gap, but it lets you kind of take the sky as opposed to travel on the ground where there might be more enemies. So me and my pawns, we get on this conveyance, we go across the gap, and I get to the other side. And as soon as I've stopped, I'm like heading off the platform, I realize one of my pawns has fallen off the mountain and died. And so there's this like pinging sound and like pinging kind of icon on your mini map to indicate one of your pawns has fallen. So you got to go revive them. So I go and revive. I kind of scamper down the mountain to revive him. And it's my main pawn, which I they kind of level up with you, whereas your other two pawns, you kind of exchange them. And I think I mentioned something like that in the first time we covered this game a little bit, is that you do change up your other two pawns regularly because they don't level up. You can put new equipment on them, but they don't gain experience points like you and your primary pawn do. So you do want to change them up often enough. Like if you gain a few levels and they're a few levels behind you and they're not going to be as effective, maybe you do want to switch them up to a different pawn. So I have done that a bunch of times. You might just want like a different pawn class for your party or different stats for your party too. So I've exchanged like a more kind of thief based class for like an archer now. I still have a mage, but it's a different mage from the one I had before. This one does ice magic as opposed to the one I started with had fire magic. At any rate, so the I went to go rescue the pawn that had fallen off the mountain. So I revive him. And then after I realized that the other two pawns I'd left behind at the top of the mountain ended up getting into trouble themselves. So one goes to like fight these three guys and he dies. And then my other pawn also falls off a different part of the mountain, so I have to go revive her. And so there was just this comedy of errors where I had to restart the game like 5 to 10 times because they kept kind of scampering off and getting into trouble. So that does happen. They do seem to find misadventure often enough. And so you do want to give them like specific orders to like wait for you or follow you or just, you know, don't go off on your own where you might find some enemies or a bit of terrain that could be tricky for them. So it was just kind of a funny little thing that happened yesterday. But so in the first area that I've now passed, the story quest or the main quest revolve around this second arisen character. You are the primary arisen. You're meant to kind of be the ruler of the land, I guess. But the queen regent has kind of concocted this plan, I suppose, to have this fake arisen character end up being the people recognize them as the emperor instead. And so there's this kind of this plot of deception and I guess these fake characters kind of trying to hold on to power, I suppose. And so you're kind of like doing some investigating of like, okay, who's going on? Who's this fake arisen character? Why? And then by at some point it ends up having the same power that you do to control the pawns based on some crystal that it's acquired. So now you have to go and look into this crystal. But you go to like a masquerade ball to get information. You kind of sneak into the castle at night. You have to wear different clothes. You have to wear like fancy clothes when you go to the noble quarter of the kingdom where the castle is. So you have to kind of dress the part. So that's kind of neat. At some point, I sold my fancy clothes by mistake, and I had to go and acquire some new ones. And fortunately, there were a bunch of outfits I could acquire to do so. But I was panicking because if you sell all of your fancy clothes, the only recourse you have is to buy these super, like, incredibly expensive ones from the store. Like, probably double the most money I've had, I would have to double that just to buy one shirt or one pair of pants from the store. So I was like, I was kind of panicking a bit that I'd sold all of the fancy clothes I'd acquired. So I had to go and, but I eventually did find another source, fortunately. So that was okay. I still think combat's interesting. As an archer, I've been playing the archer the whole time. So I'm kind of ready to try a new class. I've just about reached the final job rank or what they call vocations, final vocation rank. I think you can find these master or maester characters that maybe teach you some super skills once you reach the end of a vocation. But I'm eager to like maybe try like a different type of archer or like a magical archer or something like that, or maybe just switch to a melee class entirely as opposed to a ranged one. But yeah, I'm excited to switch vocations now that I'm in the second area and almost maxed out the current one that I'm at. Archer has been fun. I do like it. Purchasing like the exploding arrows, they do a ton of damage to bosses, and I feel like it's a good one because more of my pawns were melee based the first little bit I've been playing here, so it made sense for me to be an archer. And I'm just now realizing that if you actually hold down the right bumper button to aim your shot, you do a ton of damage with those shots, as opposed to the kind of auto aiming basic fire that you do with the X button, I guess. So I'm still kind of learning a little bit about how the combat works. The side quests are pretty interesting. There's still a lot of like just running around the world and people approaching you and offering you a quest. There's still that kind of dynamic quality that has hooked me in early on. It's still happening. And now that I'm in a new world or a new part of the world, kind of the south, I guess, west part of the continent, which is more of like a desert kind of wasteland type space. There's still a lot of kind of jungle areas to it, but there's also a lot of like crags and mountains and valleys, as opposed to like the forests and water areas of the first area. So the change in environment, I think, is nice. It was about time to move on from that space that I had been in. I like that when you go around the world, there's lots of caves. You kind of just go into a cave and it'll have treasure, or it'll have like a mini boss that you have to fight. And I still find the bosses pretty tough. Like there are moments where a giant beast can just kind of swoop in out of nowhere and you can fight it or not. And often I do choose the not part, unless I'm accompanied or surrounded by kind of just NPCs that are hanging around the world, whether that's random pawns that are walking around or just characters in the world, like an army or members of an army that can support me in that battle. And if we do 10 on 1 against a griffin, I feel a little bit safer there. I feel like a little bit better chance of taking them down. But if it's just my squad, it's a little bit harder to fight some of these bosses that have multiple health meters. David, I don't know if you remember the boss system. I remember we talked about it focusing on like climbing the enemies and stuff like that. Like, yeah. I'm not doing that as an archer, although I think I can, but I do see my companions do this. Like, they'll climb on the top of
like, see the pawns climbing.
Oh, yeah, it's so funny to see them up there. I'm like, okay, well, I really should try to draw the enemy's attention if my pawn is like climbing the back of like this cyclops or this minotaur kind of enemy. So that's still happening. I'm just not the person, I guess, who's starting the shenanigans, but it is funny just to see it taking place. And when you do knock an enemy down, one of these big guys, when they hit the ground, they're super weak to your damage, and you can just wail on them. And that's where you take down these multiple life meters. But until you get to that point, like I'm having trouble with these. There's these big wraiths that cast a bunch of magic spells, and they've got two or three health meters. And I can hit them because I'm ranged, but my pawns that aren't ranged, they're kind of just waiting for the wraith to go down to the ground. And that doesn't happen very, very often. So those enemies are giving me a lot of trouble. But yeah, I still think it's a really, really good game. It has a ton of Skyrim vibes. And I think that anyone who really has a lot of fondness for Skyrim or is missing that game would really enjoy this one. It doesn't have the same kind of maybe accessibility as Skyrim in terms of like labeling everything and the quick fast travel and all that stuff, but I do think that the dynamic world kind of makes up for that. The fact that I'm just kind of walking around and I feel like anything can happen at any time, whether that's a giant enemy swooping down, me going past a caravan and them asking for my help, or just what the next quest is going to be. Like, I really don't know what the next, like an apparition appeared to me. I'm just walking down the main road of this new area and an apparition appeared. He's like, oh yeah, you should probably go here. And he's kind of, he's kind of guiding me towards the next main quest things. But I really don't even know what kind of side quest to expect. Or I got to the next like major village area. And I'm trying to get to the inn because I'm my health is devastated. I'm all my characters need to rest. And I walk past the tavern beside the inn. And the head of the tavern is basically like, we don't take kindly to pawns around here. And he sends three guys out to challenge me. And so it's a 3-on-1 fight. I'm like, I have no health. I have no health. I don't have a lot of curative items left. I don't have my like healing magician to bring my health back if I do get hurt. And it's got that system where your maximum health meter will decrease after you start taking damage. So my max health is like 20%. Of my health meter right now. So I'm in big trouble. And I don't realize right away that these three guys he's kind of set upon me, I don't need to fight them by myself. I can ask my pawns to help me. They were kind of just chilling in the corner, but I run past them. I'm like, and I give them a command to join me. And so they do join the fight with me. And then after that fight, what, some, I guess a random passerby or maybe the tavern guy who ended up starting the whole thing. He's like, oh, that was really smart of you to ask your pawns for help. I'm like, yeah, like I had no choice. Like I had no chance in this fight. If I didn't go 4-4 against your 3-1 against 3, I was a goner. But it was just funny for him to like that my decision-making was complimented by, I think it was just a random guy that was kind of walking by. He's like, oh, that was pretty clever of you. Like, yeah, I don't know why the fight was 3-on-1 to begin with. But yeah, I'm in this village that they're all very anti-pawn. And so I have to do these side quests to restore people's faith in pawns or something like that. But it's a wild game. I love how I'm just constantly surprised by what's happening, or I just don't know what to expect, I guess. It has that really nice surprise factor to it. So yeah, still very much into it. I don't even know how far I am into the game. There's no gauge to me of like how much progress I've made, really. Like I'd see all the side quests I've done. I'm level 25, if that means something to anybody listening out there. I don't know what level you'd be at the end of the game or something like that, but I'm definitely not rushing through it. I'm taking my time, just kind of soaking it in. And yes, planning to get back to Rebirth in about a week or so, now that classes are finished for me at the college. But yeah, I've been playing Dragon's Dogma 2 almost every night and having a ball with it. So yeah, still recommending it for sure.
Well, it certainly sounds like fun. It's a game I'd probably get into, but there's so many RPGs coming out that it's just been an absolute onslaught of like, now I've downloaded the Saga Emerald Beyond demo onto Switch to give that a try before it comes out, and then we got the 100 Heroes coming out, and it's just like it's just nonstop. So
yeah, it's a shame because I really do think you would like this game because I know you're such a big fan of Skyrim. We both are, and that's the closest analog I think for this game. Yeah. I can see why people would bounce off the first game. They are this one and Dragon's Dogma 2. They are very similar, but there's enough like kind of quality of life things that this game does. Not more handholdy, but it just I think it's easier to just figure out things to do. You know, like when people tell like you just have, it goes back to that kind of traditional RPG rule of talk to everybody. I find that the more I talk to people and just kind of think about the words they're actually telling me. Like a guy's like, oh, you know, give me a little bit of time to like figure out what's going on next. I literally go and sleep in my house. Like I bought a house in the first town. I go and sleep in my house and then I go back to him. He's like, oh, I figured it out. I'm like, okay, that made a lot of sense. Like you told me you just needed some time. So I go and sleep. I go to the next day and then the story kind of passed. Like the time passing allowed us to jump to the next part of the quest. And there's a lot to do in this game with time passing. Like different characters in different spots during different parts of the day. Like you can, for some reason, the masquerade ball I attended only happens every second night. So you have to kind of adjust for that too. And I think the way the game plays with time and timing of events, I think is very interesting as well. So again, that just kind of adds to the dynamic quality of the world that your timing of where you're reaching a point will be different from if I were doing that or another player that goes there at night or in midday or something like that. So yeah, that's really cool too. I'll give you one more side quest that I did before we move on to our contest here. So I get to this border town that's kind of at the edge between the two major regions that I've been to now. And there's multiple ways to get past the border checkpoint to get to the second area. But one of the quests that happens in this checkpoint town or this border town is you have two characters who ask you for this this diamond or some kind of artifact, and you can get the artifact, you acquire it, you pick it up or you buy it or something like that, and then you can give it to one of the guys and just complete the quest. But you can also go to this shop that makes forgeries, and you can get this shop to make a forgery of this artifact. And then give one person the genuine article and give one person the forgery. And if you give the wrong guy the forgery, he literally takes it back to the artifact, to the shop. And he's like, I want you to check and see if this is authentic. And so you can get caught out in the lie. And then they won't actually give you they won't fulfill the quest for you. They won't give you like the same experience points and goodies that you would get from giving him the genuine article. And so I thought that was really funny. I ended up the one character who would check it very thoroughly, I gave him the real one. So he went and tested it out. He checked it out. He's like, oh, you gave me the right one. Like, you know, thank you. It's very nice. And then this other guy who's just kind of like a maybe a little bit of lesser character or lesser stature, like just a merchant or something. I gave him the fake one and he was so happy to have it. He like just went on his merry way with this fake artifact. And I think at some point down the line, I'm probably going to run into them again, or that I don't think this quest is completely finished.
There will be a consequence.
There's going to be, I will get my comeuppance at some point, you know, so I'm looking forward to running into this character. I think he was going to take the artifact and like sell it to somebody else. So maybe I'm going to learn about
you're gonna
the
find him dead.
I'm going to find him dead down the line. Like, oh, like, oh, I caused this. I caused this by not giving him the genuine one. But at the time when I did kind of make appease both parties, you know, I walked away like a bandit because I was getting full experience points and gold and items and everything like that. But yeah, I think there is going to be some kind of comeuppance conclusion to this event or this side quest that's probably not beneficial for me. I think it'll come and get me at some point. So I'm looking forward to that kind of wrapping up. And then there are just things like that where you do a quest for somebody and they recognize you, or you know they're appreciative of you. There's a character in the palace where I've done multiple quests for him, and he seemed like a beggar. A boy or something earlier on, but it turns out he's like the prince or something. So just a lot of cool discoveries to make here. So yeah, David, I want you to play this at some point this year, even if it's not, you know, a busy April month. But yeah, if the game goes on sale, you got to snag this, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely on my radar. So
right on,
one day for sure.
Sounds good.
All right, so we will break into the debate now, and so like we said at the beginning, I'll be on the PlayStation side, Jordan will be on the Super Nintendo side, but I think in both cases, the debate is going to hinge, I think, largely on the primary RPG publisher, developer of the time, and in both cases, Square Enix was the clear, or not Square Enix, but Square, I guess, at the time, is the clear leader on both platforms. Their RPGs were, I think, the most dominant. They were the most recognized, did the best. This is when Square was basically, you know, I think at its peak in quality and just kind of its domination of the RPG genre at the time. And so in my opinion, I feel like that favors my side of the argument, because I'm of the opinion that the Sony, it's when Square made the switch over to Sony, you know, during the transition to the 3D era, and they became a Sony brand at that point, I feel like that's when Square really became like what we know Square is today, like this this cutting edge, this leader. They're always striving to push whatever console it's on at the time to its limits, really kind of setting the bar for RPGs. You know, it started with Final Fantasy VII. You know, I could go on hours about it's how big of a deal Final Fantasy VII was. Like,
yeah, have we talked about Final Fantasy VII as a game enough this month? Yeah. Like,
that's why I'm just going to avoid that, because we've got about 100 episodes on the feed. That's probably
feels like it, yeah.
Regarding it, but even with like Final Fantasy VIII, Final Fantasy IX, Final Fantasy Tactics, like these are all like legendary games from Square. Usually, when you're seeing people's top lists of their favorite Final Fantasies, these ones, particularly 7 and 9, are you know, on lists, and people with good taste will have Final Fantasy VIII up there too. And, you know, this is also where, you know, Uematsu got to really break free of the constraints of the sound quality or the what he was able to do on a platform, because, you know, when he switched over, I think it was, you know, he had Final Fantasy VII was kind of his first go into it, and like, look how legendary that track is. But then as soon as like they really started being able to use the capabilities, like the CD audio quality of the PlayStation really opened up new things for him. And then it was even funny, like looking back, like even now, like Sakaguchi still believes that Final Fantasy IX was his favorite Final Fantasy game. It was kind of like his, what is it, the Magnus Opus or whatever. You know, it was, it's funny even going to play, I think I played it a year or two ago, and just realizing like how much of an homage it was at the time of like all the Final Fantasy games up to that point. And again, it's one that people still admire to this day. I just feel like Square Enix, they became what they are during this age.
I think it's, I mean, I agree with you. I think that their output on Super Nintendo, obviously prolific. I'm going to get into that in a minute, but there's no getting around the fact that what they were able to do on Sony's platform and just kind of harnessing the new CD format for games is revolutionary for sure. The music, obviously fantastic, but the stories, the storytelling, incredible here, right? 7, 8, 9 and Tactics, you know, an excellent game. We 9 and Tactics are interesting because it sounds like, or feels like, both of those games are up for remake in the next couple of years. You know, I think we're going to see at least one, maybe both of those games resurface soon. And so the kind of discussion around those original games and kind of how they are transformed onto modern platforms is going to be really interesting. We're going to be talking more about them soon, I think, and hopefully kind of revisiting them, the original versions, which are excellent, and see how they are brought forward to PlayStation 5 or whatever series of platforms ends up getting the remakes. I'm eager to see that. But yes, I mean, I'll speak more to 7, 9, and Tactics. 7, I can't get around the fact that's it's an all-timer for sure. If anyone puts Final Fantasy 7 at the top of their RPG list or the top of their Square Enix or Final Fantasy list, I totally understand that. Like I can, and there are days where I feel that way too. Like where I think 7 is the best, and I love the Materia system, and I think the kind of in-game boss fights are incredible. Golden Saucer, the mini games, all of those super fun. When the games got re-released on Switch, like I think we replayed a bunch of them, right? Like 7 and 9, especially. And I think the game still holds up very well. I think the writing, the humor, the characters, all of that stuff comes through. We've kind of seen in FF7 Remake and Rebirth, like just how much life there was to that world, and how it could just be fleshed out and made so much stronger, more pronounced. But I think that speaks to what was already there originally, right? And the relationships between characters, kind of what their archetypes were, how they act. A lot of that stuff is still coming through from the original game. And so 7 is an all-timer and really kind of cemented the PlayStation 1 as, you know, this it's going to be this place where RPGs go and they're made great, and their unforgettable experiences are possible here. I think of those four Final Fantasy games on PS1, I think Tactics is probably my second favorite. I love the job system. It's a story that's very kind of serious and adult, and you know, betrayal and deception, and it's kind of, at least to me, it felt the most grown up, or I maybe that's the thing that resonated with me about its story, is that what's happening here, like, I hadn't really experienced to the same extent in games. It's really treating you like a grown up, like someone who is sophisticated enough to understand what's happening here. But great characters. I think some of the re-releases improved upon the original in some ways, but, and obviously, you know, there were limitations. I think they were really pushing the hardware too with a game like this, especially with like the summons and stuff like that. But the Tactics gameplay still holds up super well. Again, I think the job system and just switching different classes and being encouraged to experiment and create your own party, I think all of that is really, really cool and interesting in Tactics. So you will not hear any argument from me about Final Fantasy VII and Tactics especially being, you know, top of the Final Fantasy pantheon and staples in the PlayStation 1 lineup for sure. I can I don't know if we want to go back and forth. I can do Square Enix stuff on
let's go a little back and forth.
Super Nintendo here. Yeah, let's do it. So So Final Fantasy, we had the three there's three Final Fantasy games on Super Nintendo.
But is there?
I know. Well, it could be three or four depending on who you ask. It could be two. It sounds like that's where David's heading. I'm not going to include Final Fantasy V just because it didn't receive a localized release on Super Nintendo. So it wasn't a game that if anyone owned a Super NES, they wouldn't have grown up with this game unless they had a Super Famicom or they had...
And spoke Japanese.
And spoke a red Japanese. I know people that did play this game or imported it and it just made their way through, even though they didn't know a lot of Japanese, or maybe they learned a bit just to get through it. Yeah. I think Chris Kohler's Final Fantasy V book for Boss Fight Books may have mentioned a similar type of story, or his experience might have been like that. But the three that I want to highlight are Final Fantasy IV, VI, and believe it or not, I will highlight Final Fantasy Mystic Quest and more on that in a minute. Final Fantasy IV is such a dramatic step up after the first three games. And playing the pixel remasters kind of allowed me to really, that idea to really hit home again. The way that the kind of characters come in and out of the party, that you think people are gone, but they're not. There's a lot of like kind of punches or twists that the game involves, and they really even kind of revisiting the game, I'm still like just amazed by how it kind of like plays with your emotions a little bit. You know, you do think people are gone or lost, but they resurface, and I think it's fantastic the way the game kind of weaves characters in and out of the story. I think that the villains are excellent. I think Golbez is a really compelling antagonist for the majority of the game. Zeromus doesn't really show up until like the final bit. I think the moon just as a whole has a bit of an issue, but the stuff they do on Earth between like the above ground world and the underground, I think it's fantastic. The four elemental fiends, fantastic antagonists as well, even though some of them you don't see as much. Rubicante is excellent. The way he kind of like plays good guy and bad guy at the same time, like the noble villain, I think is excellent.
Yeah.
I love how everyone has their own kind of job class, and like that's what you figure out. Like I'm traditionally a person who doesn't change job classes a lot. So 4 resonates with me a lot because everyone kind of has their own role, and so they're good at the thing they do. And I like, for that's me. I like that. I like leveling up and learning new spells, you know, as opposed to like kind of customizing. The customizing is fun, but for just kind of being this first big RPG experience on Super Nintendo, I think was really a kind of an excellent beginning for Square on the platform. 6, I mean, there's not a lot to say about 6 that hasn't been said. For me, it's probably my favorite Final Fantasy still. I think it is the best one. Again, replaying that, the pixel remaster, you're reminded that Final Fantasy was cinematic, or could be cinematic, before it came to PlayStation. Like the beginning of Final Fantasy 6, I don't think it's been topped in an RPG, let alone, you know, some video games. Like it is such an iconic, memorable opening to a game. It uses, you know, the Super Nintendo Mode 7 in maybe the best way that Mode 7 is used on the platform. And again, maybe a little known technology, but it's what enables that opening to be so compelling. And it's simple too. It's just these robots just walking in the snow. There's no action to it.
No.
There's no like bombastic kind of sequencing or anything like that. It's so simple and perfect, and leads into the game so well. It kind of sets up the desolation of the second half of the game, right? That we start and end with a world that is kind of just barren and empty, and not a lot is living, right? But the cast of 6 is absolutely incredible. The set pieces, Kefka, it maybe hasn't been topped as a villain in any RPG ever. Like you can make arguments like that. But I don't want to belabor the fact that I think FF6 is still timeless. I included it in my book for a reason. It is such an incredible experience that I think people who have never played an RPG can get into 6 and it maybe turn them into a fan. If you're into RPGs and you've never played that game, I can't imagine why you haven't gone to it yet. It's so good. But yeah. But one more Final Fantasy game for me from Super Nintendo. And this is the reason why I think it is worth mentioning as an interesting game on Super Nintendo, at least. Mystic Quest was kind of developed as a game, kind of a gateway to RPGs. It's not meant to be like, oh, if you're an RPG fan, you're going to love this one. It's not really like that. It's meant to be like, oh, you've never played RPGs before. Like, here are some of the things they can do that are interesting. You only have a maximum of two characters in your party. I think the way that you kind of explore the overworld, it's very simplified. Like, there's not like this dense kind of dense landscapes to explore. You basically go into a town, you get a character who has bombs, then you can bomb the rock wall that's blocking you. And then you kind of repeat that process through every part of the game. Like, oh, you have an axe. Okay, I need an axe to chop down the tree to make my way through. And so even just progressing through the game, like, it's all quite simplified. But if you've never played an RPG before, I think it is a good kind of way to get you into them. It is definitely baby's first RPG. And so I'm sure there are people that got into Mystic Quest thinking, okay, like, I kind of like this, but I want more. I want different. I want more of a challenge. And then you can seek out, you know, Chrono Trigger and Secret of Mana and Final Fantasy VI and realize that there are games that build off of this or do a lot more that can. And if you've whet your appetite on Mystic Quest, you can get there. I think the music in parts is really good. The combat, again, it's everything's very basic and simplified, but not bad per se. Just not enough. Like, it's a game that's more of an appetizer than a main course. And I think if you see it that way, I do have some respect for it, for what it's trying to do. It's, to me, it's almost like the Super Mario Brothers 2 of the Super Nintendo, right?
That's
like
an interesting game, way to look at it.
That we didn't get lost levels. It was going to be too hard. And if maybe, for someone just picking up a Super Nintendo, their first game. Okay, if their first game is Final Fantasy VI, that could be tricky, right? There's a lot going on in that game. But if you played Mystic Quest, you're like, oh, okay, I like this, but I'm looking for more. Or this was a good kind of, you know, a good experience, but I found it a little bit too easy or whatever. Then going to Final Fantasy VI afterwards, you know, you're like, oh my goodness, like, Square Enix also made this. Like, imagine that leap from Mystic Quest to 6 or 4. Or Chrono Trigger or something like that. Just very eye-opening, I'm to say the least, I'm sure. But yeah, I'll close off the Final Fantasies there, and I'll do a little more Square Enix in a minute, but I'll toss it over to you, David, for some more PS1 games.
Yeah, well, I'll stay on the Square Enix train a little bit here for my side, because, again, Square was putting out just hit after hit on the PlayStation, so I'll just run through a few of them. So we have Xenogears, which to this day is still very iconic. Lots of people still have it on their top RPG lists. We're all going to pretend like they didn't run out of money during the third act, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We have Tactics Ogre, which just recently got a remaster that's been very, very well received, I believe. Mm-hmm. Last year when it came out, unfortunately, it came out when there was like 30 other Square games being released. Exactly. But doesn't take away from that game. I know there's a game with the word Chrono in it that you're going to be talking about in a minute. But we did get one on PlayStation. I'm not going to pretend like it was better than the first, but Chrono Cross was still good in its own right. We had Vagrant Story, which is, again, another game that I can't believe it hasn't been remastered or put on a new platform at this point. It makes you wonder if there's like some kind of rights issue, which I can't understand how that could be, but just really weird. And then PlayStation had what many consider the best Dragon Quest on it. I know a lot, most people probably know Dragon Quest VII from the 3DS. But technically, it started on PlayStation first. So, we've got all of these incredible Square games that came out on the PlayStation. Again, it was just like, and these aren't even from, like, again, they were focusing on Final Fantasy. So, you know, you had Square's main focus there, but then you still had all these bangers that were coming out on the platform as well from everyone else at the company. So yeah, there was all those, and then I don't know, they're just games that are still very playable today. Like, you could still pick up these original discs. You know, in a lot of cases, like I said, there's been remasters, especially with like Tactics Ogre and Chrono Cross. But you know, it's still, you could find these original games and still enjoy them in their own right today if you still got your PS1 or even your PS2, because you can slop those discs in there too. So,
or your Vita, David. I mean, I played at least two of those games on Vita. So
yeah,
Zero Gears and Vagrant Story. I played both of them on Vita, which was great.
Yeah,
I think that what those titles make me think of is just the breadth of the lineup on PlayStation 1 RPG wise, right? You have so many different experiences. They're not all like strictly turn-based or strictly fantasy or whatever. Like, you have a lot of different kind of experimentations happening, right? Like, even within the Final Fantasy games, that was happening too, but the side games, I hate to call them side games because they're not, like, they're different. They're not kind of mainline titles in a series or something like that, but they are in a lot of ways experimental, right? Especially with
new franchises. Let's call them new franchises.
Yeah, new franchises. Yeah. And they would end up, you know, look at what came from Xenogears, right? You ended up getting Xenoblade. And now that's become one of the more prolific RPG series that exists now, 1, 2, and 3, and then the DLC for some of those games too. So just the way that Square Enix would kind of build off of titles that came up on PlayStation, they would experiment early on, and then those experiments would continue to bear fruit, you know, with some exceptions. You know, not everything's going to be a surefire hit. But the experimentations, I think, have led to some of the greatest RPGs of all time, right? And that's what we can really kind of respect or laud them for, is that they took chances and they weren't afraid to, you know, try things out that weren't necessarily going to be super mainstream. I think Xenogears is a game to me that, like, I played it. I don't completely resonate with it, but I do respect and appreciate the way that it's doing new things we hadn't really seen in RPGs. And again, things probably were only possible on the PlayStation because of that medium. It's multiple discs, right? I believe. And it's something that they were so ambitious, they couldn't finish it. Right. Yeah. Like that's how much was going on there, is that, they just ran out of money to finish the game. That's how
eyes bigger than their pockets.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. And, but I would rather that way of approaching things than you know, just playing it too safe, playing it too easy. Like, you did play it easy with something like Final Fantasy Mystic Quest, but then now that you're on a new platform, it's time to kind of take some risks, and you have all that Final Fantasy 7 money, right? Like, you might want to spend it doing something new with something like Xenogears. Even Vagrant Story, I think, is experimental too. So I don't love these games. I know other people do, but I do respect them for trying new things, for sure. We'll pop over to me again for the remainder of the Square Enix and Squaresoft, Square, whatever you want to call them, lineup on Super Nintendo. And among these, I think we have, you know, at least not my trump card, but the game that I think could be the reason why Super Nintendo just wins this contest, and I'll start there, and that's Chrono Trigger. You'd be hard pressed to find people who have played a lot of RPGs, Chrono Trigger among them, and not consider Chrono Trigger one of their top three, if not their favorite RPG of all time. It is so perfect an experience, from the characters, the combat, the world, storytelling, just the way it looks, the way it's presented, the jumping between different time periods. All of it is so magical and whimsical, but also, you know, there are a lot of serious moments in that story too, from when you lose Chrono and your team is kind of floundering without him, but you still have to persevere, to like just the very simple act of waking up in the morning, your mom is opening the curtains in your bedroom. I have that scene in art form on my kid's bedroom wall. The cat, you kind of you pet him and he makes the little meow sound. There's so many little touches to that game that make it incredibly special. It's lengthy. It's got multiple endings. The boss fights are really, really great, and there's lots of them. I think it has good villains too. Magus is a good villain, and if you can even join your party, which is crazy. almost like a shadow kind of thing from Final Fantasy VI. But the fact that the final boss is just available to you basically at any point is really cool. Like, you can go and fight Lavos at, you know, a dozen different spots in the game. And most of the time you won't be ready to fight him, but you could be, you know, or you'll get a different ending depending on when you fight him. It's one of the first games, I think, to have a memorable New Game Plus mode where you carry over everything and then you have that opportunity to go and chase the 9 different endings or whatever. The DS game is obviously very good. I think it improves on the Super Nintendo one in some ways, but that's even possible. Maybe it's portable, but that's cool. But Chrono Trigger, yeah, not too much else needs to be said about Chrono Trigger. It's a must play. If you've played it, you know that. I still think, and they still haven't done anything with it really, like, which is surprising. Like, that it's not on modern platforms. I can't understand why. Maybe that's a rights or licensing issue as well. Who knows? But this game hopefully will resurface in some form in the next few years. I'm looking forward to that day. I think it'll be awesome. The other two, one is kind of not a cheat. It's a Square game for sure, but it's also a Nintendo game, and that's Super Mario RPG, which did recently get a remake. And the funny thing about that remake is it doesn't change very much. Like, it looks different, but it plays very, very similar. And I think that it's being responsible for kind of ushering in the timing attacks and timing defense that are a huge part of RPGs now, especially indie RPGs. We see a lot of games playing around with making combat turn-based, but also having a dynamic quality to it where the player has more agency in how much damage or they take or receive based on, you know, them being a little bit more skillful with their button presses and timing and thinking things like that. Like, just trying to make the combat more engaging, I guess. And so our Super Mario RPG is kind of the first place where that happened for me, for sure. And again, it's also really special for putting Mario in a different space, right? He's out of the platforming space and into an RPG. It's just like, if you liked RPGs and you liked Mario, it was a dream for you, right? It was a match made in heaven to combine those two things. Just to see Square be given the keys to Nintendo property was also really cool, right? Like, there's, you're fighting Bowser's on your team, Peach's on your team. You are fighting Mario enemies, right? You're doing a race with Yoshi. Like, to see all those things in an RPG world was so cool, so magical. And again, we haven't gotten a ton of experiences like that since, where another major developer is taking a genre that hasn't seen these characters before and kind of turning it on its head. I think of something coming out maybe this year, like, oh gosh, I'm drawing a little bit of a blank here. It's a tactics game that is taking an arcade property, not Metal Slug, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Metal Slug is doing that this year, where they're taking something, an arcade game, like a run and gun, and making a tactics game out of it. I'm so excited about this game. I can't wait to see more of it. But it's doing something just totally out of left field. And that, to me, that was Super Mario RPG. For to be, again, just taking things that I wasn't expecting and making a new game out of it. Really, really cool. And of course, I got to shout out Secret of Mana. I think for a lot of people, that's one of their first loves on the Super Nintendo. Really charming world, incredible soundtrack. I think parts of Secret of Mana don't hold up as well. And then to finally get to play Trials of Mana, both in the original form and the remake, highlights maybe how that game has grown from the second game, Secret of Mana. Maybe it doesn't show the second game in as much of a great light. But I think when it first came out, like, a really cool experience. And one of the only games on both of our lists to be multiplayer, which is really cool as well. I think you're going to shout out a couple multiplayer games as well. But for this to be like three players, like a three-player action RPG, was really cool. And that you had to find the friend in your group who had a multi-tap that they probably got from Bomberman, right? Because Bomberman on Super Nintendo was included with the multi-tap to connect up to four controllers, but you can do three in Secret of Mana when you eventually acquire all the three party members. And that was just a really unique experience as well that I hadn't had to that point. Kind of playing through most of the game in multiplayer was really fun. So Yeah, Square Enix rounding out their output on Super Nintendo with some different games, but among them, you know, maybe the best RPG ever.
Yeah, solid list. If we're going head to head on the top ones on each one, if someone came out to me and said, "Okay, I have Chrono Trigger and I have Final Fantasy VII, you can have one, but you can never play the other ever again."
Yeah,
I would still go with VII.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. I mean, VII has more to it, right? It's a bigger game, the bigger world. Chrono Trigger, in some ways, is fairly contained, you know, especially because within every time period, it is a small world, right? There's only so many places you can go. I think,
And even though Chrono Cross was a sequel, it really wasn't. Like,
no,
Chrono Trigger is still like a one and done.
Yeah, it totally is. And Chrono Cross, like, I do like that game a lot. I think it might have the best music of any game that we've mentioned so far. Like, the soundtrack is incredible, and it's so iconic. Yeah,
I've got that soundtrack on my at work list.
Yeah. I constantly just bring it up on Spotify. I'm like, oh, I feel like, you know, it's a kind of a tranquil day. Let's put on some Chrono Cross, or maybe if I'm going for a long drive by myself, kids in the car, or my wife in the car, something like that, I'll throw on Chrono Cross because it's just great traveling music too. Chrono Cross, the music of that game, I remember when I was in grade 8, we were on a basketball trip. Like, we were taking a bus somewhere in the interior of BC. And I burned a disc of Chrono Cross songs. And I'm just listening to this soundtrack. Like, I probably only put 10 songs on it, but I'm listening to it on repeat for like this 4-hour bus ride. And I didn't listen to anything else. I'm just like, this is perfect. Like, it's making me nostalgic. It's making me feel like sentimental, like, just an incredible one. I do love Chrono Cross a lot. I don't think it's nearly as great as Trigger, but it does a lot of neat things for sure.
Well, thank you for reminding me that PlayStation discs could be put into CD.
That's right, exactly. Yeah,
and you could listen to music. So yeah. there's another notch in my belt.
Feather in your cap. Yeah,
yeah.
No, totally. We couldn't do that with a Super Nintendo cartridge, unfortunately. No,
it would be tough.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we should go outside of Square. Yes. We can't. This whole debate can't
rock. For once in the Thirsty Mage's history, we'll talk about something.
We'll go outside. And so on for mine, I have three that I'll point out. So one is that the best Castlevania is on PlayStation, and it's the best because partly in because they lean so heavily into the RPG aspect, but also it's just a very well-designed game, and that's Symphony of the Night. I'm sure there's some debate on whether it's the best, but it's certainly my favorite, and I know many others would agree.
I can't believe it took us so long to play it.
Like, I know it.
That's the biggest surprise. It's like,
well, you know why? Is because I've never been like a Castlevania fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I played the NES games when I was a kid. So I kind of had that was what Castlevania was to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then Castlevania 4, I feel like, was just like a bigger version of the NES games.
Exactly. Yeah. It's same kind of thing. Yeah.
You know, it's just that much different. So it was like, yeah, totally different experience. Now, I've never played this game, but I know this is Casey and one of your favorite franchises, and this is where the original Diablo. Now, I know it started off as a PC game, but it did come to PlayStation, and I'm pretty sure Casey has said that's where he first played.
I think that's Diablo. Right. Yeah,
yeah, no. was on a friend's PlayStation, or watching it on a friend's PlayStation. I don't know if he got to play it too much, but so the Diablo franchise that's still alive and strong today there. And Atlus, you know, back then Atlus was, I think, mostly Japan based. But we did get a Persona 2 Eternal Punishment on the original PlayStation. And again, I haven't played it myself, but looking forward to, I'm going to be trying to find a copy of it so I can play it. But I mean, the Persona is today one of the bigger RPG franchises, and you know, this is probably a good place for if you want to get like that you know, very old school feeling. I doubt you're going to go back to a Super Nintendo version of Persona. I'm sure most people are going to start here on PlayStation.
That's right. Yeah.
So pretty three strong you know, franchises that are at their peak on or got their start on PlayStation.
Totally, yeah. I mean, Symphony of the Night maybe hasn't been eclipsed as far as Metroidvanias go, and it's certainly one that, look at how many games spun off of Symphony of the Night, right? Like, you have all these GBA games, the DS games as well, and the more modern interpretations like Bloodstained and stuff like that. We're still seeing games that clearly are riffing on or built on the back of Symphony of the Night. So, iconic, excellent game, so fun. Can't believe it took so long to play it, but man, I'm glad we did. And we did a whole episode on it, so please go and look that up if you haven't. Symphony of the Night is a gem for sure. Yeah, it's funny to include the original Diablo here, because I'm sure there are people like Casey that did play the game first on PlayStation, and it does have couch co-op, which is cool, right? Like, you can play that game, I think, just two players on a single screen with two controllers. I never had that experience myself, but I'm sure others have, and it sounds like that'd be a fun way to go through the game. I would play more Diablo multiplayer in the later games on PC, but interesting that you could do that with local multiplayer on the original game on PlayStation. Persona 2, not a game I've ever played. Again, another one that I think is maybe getting a remake or a re-release at some point. I think that's been rumored or talked about. We'll see if that comes to fruition. I don't know that it's as playable or as kind of user-friendly as Persona games would become, but to see where it started is pretty cool. And again, that's something that PlayStation is just going to be known for in the RPG space, is giving a lot of franchises their start, or seeing kind of glimpses of what their modern incarnations would be. We're seeing those hints, those looks behind the curtain on PlayStation 1, because of all the experimentation that was happening with the new technology, the new hardware, and all of the possibilities that is even just a CD medium unlocked for them. So, yeah, respect for sure. Symphony of the Night, more than just respect. That's an excellent call, and it's definitely one of the ones I would highlight in looking at kind of like, oh, is PlayStation 1 better for RPGs? Yeah, Symphony of the Night, absolute banger. Man, what a good game. I'll go to a few of my non-Square Enix ones. I'm trying to figure out how I can group these ones. So I'll do kind of RPGs that maybe kind of look outside the box a little bit. So the first one I want to highlight is absolute personal favorite of mine, and that's come up multiple times on this podcast, and that's Earthbound. Earthbound, I love this game. I absolutely adore it. It's one of my favorite RPGs. And I can appreciate why people wouldn't say it's one of the best, or why they bounce off it. It does have a lot of kind of old school things that are hard to kind of penetrate. The early part of the game, when you just have one character in your team, those fights can be really tough. You do have to do a bunch of grinding, I think, in this game, for the most part, to get through. It's not one where you can just kind of use skill to get through some of the tough boss fights. You do have to improve Ness's stats and make sure you've got the best equipment and stuff like that. But once the game gets rolling, you've got multiple party members. You've got like more magical skills to hit enemy weaknesses and to paralyze them and stuff like that. It hits its stride and it doesn't stop. The quirky out of left field environments you go to, like Foreside, this big city, and then you see the reverse of it, this darkened version called Moonside. The craziest things are happening there. Like, people are like, you talk to people and they teleport you halfway across town. All these inanimate objects come to life and fight you, you know, like stop signs and paintings and things like that. The enemy variety is through the roof in this game. Like, everywhere you go, you're fighting different enemies, and they're all hilarious and have their own hilarious dialogue and things that they, attacks that they do. The game is genuinely funny. Like, it is one of the funniest RPGs that exists. The dialogue is so good. The writing, just all the events that take place, the sound effects and the music, all of it contribute to a game that just, it can make you smile from ear to ear throughout the whole runtime. It's one of those games where you talk to everybody, not because they're helpful, but because they're hilarious. Like, you want it to just someone sitting in the hotel, or someone just hanging out in the desert, go and talk to them because they're probably gonna have something funny to say. And so Earthbound, thinking about it and playing it always just brings a smile to my face. And it's a game if I needed picking up after, you know, some a down kind of moment in my life, like, Earthbound would be one of those games I'd go to first. The others, or another one that kind of stands out for me, and I was thinking about it this week as we were kind of preparing for the episode, and that's EVO, The Search for Eden. Not a game I've replayed anytime recently, but one I think about often for some reason.
I remember reading about this in Attendant Power.
Yeah, exactly. And I would have rented many times. EVO, The Search for Eden is a game where you start off basically as like nothing. You start off as like a little fish. And the point of the game is to kind of keep evolving your creature until you can walk on land and then eventually fly. You start off as kind of like prehistoric, like nothing creatures, maybe like a dinosaur. And then you kind of just go through different epochs of evolution, and your character, he just keeps growing. You can add tails, you can add a horn, improve your teeth to have a stronger bite. And so you're leveling up by like attacking things smaller than you or fighting bosses and being strategic about it. And you're just kind of going through these different individual stages, not only stages of like a little video game stage, but then stages of evolution as well. So it was developed by a company called Almanac. And I don't think they did anything else major on Super Nintendo. I think their output in Japan was a little bit more prolific, but published by Enix. So I thought, you know, worth throwing out there is another cool game that they published. Enix would go on to publish a bunch of interesting games on Super Nintendo, even if they didn't develop those themselves necessarily. A few more games that they published but didn't develop, Robotrek, Illusion of Gaia, and ActRaiser, the Quintet games, which I know a lot of people are really into. And you might have your favorite one. ActRaiser is a very quality game. It's got a simulation aspect that makes it really cool. And then a kind of action platforming sequences. So some RPG elements, even if we wouldn't classify it necessarily as a traditional RPG. Illusion of Gaia, kind of same thing. Action RPG type game with a lot of elements in common with Zelda. But the story, the characters, the way that you kind of transform in the dungeon segments into different characters as well, all reminding me of RPGs. And each of the different forms, I think, can level up on its own as well, which is cool. Robotrek, a game I think I've mentioned a couple times on the podcast. Interesting for its experimenting with kind of party building. You construct these robots, and then the robots are the ones that go into battle for you. So almost a Pokemon-esque element to it. And you can give your robots different combos, different equipment. You kind of build them out how you want them to be. And from then on, it's just kind of generic turn-based combat. But a lot of the game has to do with kind of building things, and you collect different pieces like scraps in the world and turn them into a device like a key or a megaphone to, you know, scare people, scare the guards so you can get into the fortress or something like that, or the compound. So it's doing cool things in the RPG space as well, I think, for its time.
Yeah, these are all games that are on my list of want to play, but none that I've played. I'm going to word this way. I have versions of this game on a platform that I could play.
Yes, good.
That I
good,
plan
good,
to good. One day.
Thank you. Yes. I want you to play EVO. I think EVO is a really cool game. I think that not enough people played it, just because it's weird and the box art doesn't sell it super well. Like, oh, what is this? Even the title doesn't really tell you what it's going to be about. But when you play it, it is quite fun.
I think the Nintendo Power episode or magazine, you know, the one that was they had on this, I think it did a really good job of selling it, because show those evolutions and what you're supposed to do. And I even think it had like that was back when they were doing the walkthroughs and stuff.
That's right. You can choose how your character like evolves. You don't have to like always build it out the same way. And every piece that you build onto your body costs different experience points. So there's that kind of how you build out your character. Maybe you want to be a little bit faster. Maybe you want to be stronger, tougher. Like, all you're kind of making those RPG choices, which is interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, these are all on the list one day. But I think what we'll do is we'll wrap up this debate with a couple of names that you and I recognize from our NES days that are still heavy hitters to this day.
100%.
And that's a Capcom versus Konami.
Yeah.
On my end, on the PlayStation, we had Konami's jump into the RPG genre with Suikoden and Suikoden 2. So these are, it's funny, these are very topical because remasters are on their way. We have the spiritual successor in 100 Heroes that's coming out shortly. So we have this all these games from Murayama, who unfortunately passed away this year. I'm almost curious if Konami was aware of Murayama's illness, and it was a maybe that's too Canadian of me to think that a company would kind of do the right thing and let Murayama's game have its own time in the sun and not be overshadowed by the remasters. I might be putting too much stock into that. Maybe it's just that they weren't ready, but I'd like to believe that, you know, Konami did a nice thing for the developers of 100 Heroes. But yeah, these are all games that I've kind of dipped my toes into Suikoden and enjoyed what I played of it. They're all on my list. I plan on picking up 100 Heroes. So yeah, this was Konami's shining on the platform back in the day, that again is the tops on many people's RPG lists.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, I'm excited to revisit the Suikoden games. I've only played the first one, and I didn't love it. I think it's it just had this bloat of characters and kind of
dense.
Like, yeah, it's very dense. It's very even the story, like the political aspect to it, very dense and maybe harder to get into. But I've heard people put Suikoden 2 among their top RPGs, and so that sentiment has been expressed to me many times, or I've read it on social media many times. So I'm excited to get into the games when they re-release, especially the second one. And then 100 Heroes being a spiritual successor, it'll be interesting to kind of put those all side by side, all three of those games, I guess. For my kind of, I guess, my final thoughts or my final arguments here, Brett, I've got two games from Capcom. Breath of Fire 1, I adored that game. I played it so much. I remember the Christmas when I got the game. I got the huge Prima strategy guide. And I was poring over that thing. I spent the whole Christmas break just reading the guide, playing the game. I was so engrossed in it. The encounter rate in both of these games is way too high. And that's the biggest knock against them. It's just there's too many random encounters. But aside from that, I think the characters are great. I love the transformations, like the different dragon transformations that the protagonist Ryu undergoes. And as you go through the game, it's not just him that has transformations. Other characters will get them too. And so you go into battle in some of the late game battles and your party looks entirely different because they've all transformed into these like super creatures, whether that's characters kind of combining with one another, which I think is possible in the second game. I think that happens, maybe even in the first, I don't remember, but there's just so many kind of dynamic party changes that happen, which is really cool. You're constantly getting like new party members by the end who are more powerful or have different abilities. I think the sprite work is great. I think everything, the towns kind of look generic, the overworld looks generic, but I think when you get into battles and you look at like enemy sprites and the character sprites, all of that looks really cool. I like the kind of, the funny thing is we're comparing these two, they kind of use a similar perspective in battle. It's kind of that diagonal kind of view, right? You're behind the back, but also off to the side a little bit, almost isometric a little bit. They both of these games, both of these franchises kind of do the same thing and with their camera view, I guess, in the combat. So that's kind of neat. But I think that Breath of Fire games, especially the second one, it's been ported a bunch of places. It's a little bit more accessible. You could even start with that one, I think. I don't think there's continuity. I think the beginning of Breath of Fire 1 in particular is quite slow until you get Nina and the ability to maybe travel the world a little bit easier. And like I said, that encounter rate is a pain. But the two games are still pretty fun. And it is a series that did continue. And I know people are hoping that we'll see Breath of Fire come about again. One of those kind of Capcom franchises I know people want to see more of. So maybe that'll happen in the future, hopefully. But 1 and 2 were started, I think, of really solid games.
Yep. Well, I think we've made our arguments. It was funny. I was just trying to think. I remember years ago we had some kind of debate.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the topic was. Do you remember what the topic was?
Like this kind of thing, like one versus the other.
We did this once before because I remember the biggest one of the criticisms we had of it was that we were both too positive about our things and not trying to bring down the others. And to that, I say, this is how Canadians debate, deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Did you expect anything else from, two people from Canada? Yeah. You might be on the wrong podcast feed.
Yeah. I mean, I would also argue that there's not much bad you can say about any of these games. So
no, and I think that that's the cool thing, right? Is that RPGs on both consoles, like they were really, really good, and you can't really go whatever one you started with or whatever one you gravitate towards, you couldn't really go wrong. They're all excellent. Like, yeah, I mean, we could say some bad things about these games. I try to highlight some of the caveats about some of them. Like, but I know for both of our lineups, there are games you don't love. Like, yeah. I don't think you love Super Mario RPG, and I don't love Final Fantasy VIII. Like, I just because I can't get into those games, or you can't get into that game, like, it doesn't mean they're bad, right? It just means that we they weren't for us.
It's a personal taste issue at that point, as opposed to quality of the game.
Exactly. I think we can agree that the lineups from both platforms are still very fun to get into today. I think a lot of these games we've mentioned, you can pick them up in 2024 and still have a blast with them. I don't think it's a situation where it's like, oh, the Super Nintendo games, they just don't hold up very well. Like, a lot of them hold up really well still, you know, and even when they're remade or re-released, like, they're still really fun. Like, again, the pixel remasters are an excellent encapsulation of the fact that those old Final Fantasy games are still playable today with a few modern touches that kind of just make the experience a little bit better. Super Mario RPG, the remake, didn't do very much, right? It's basically the same game. Yeah. I don't know, and then the Final Fantasy games as well. Like, we had 7, 8, 9 all ported over to Switch and Xbox and stuff like that, and you can play them now, and they're still, they added, like, the speed-up option or the instant win option. They didn't need to change the games that much because they're still ultimately very playable today.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've laid it out on the line. The debate between them for this episode is finished, but now the debate on the comments, whether it's in Spotify or YouTube or in the Discord, it's time for everyone else to make the decision and debate away on which of these two platforms had the slightly better catalog.
Yeah.
So we'll leave it in the hands of the listeners.
That's right. We're not going to do it. We've done the heavy lifting of bringing up all the games and kind of giving points of comparison. But we want everyone else out there to choose. OK, what is it? What's the better RPG platform? Is it the Super Nintendo? Is it the PS1? Both excellent. Both reasons for having that, having the belt, having the title. But yeah, it's in your hands now. We'll leave it up to you after an hour of our discussion here.
That's right.
So we'll wrap up here. Hope everyone has been enjoying our discussions of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. We wanted to kind of diverge a little bit from that, talk a little bit more Dragon's Dogma 2, and then, yeah, get into some classic games because we haven't talked about those in a hot minute. But yeah, let us know what your thoughts are. You know, which console do you think is the RPG, the ruler of all RPGs? You know, is it too close to call? Let us know what your thoughts are. You can email us, david@thethirstymage.com. You know, come join our Discord. There's always a link to that on the website or in the podcast feeds as well. You can always get to our Thirsty Mage Discord. You know, we'd love to hear your thoughts on it there too. But yeah, that'll do it for this week, everybody. Thanks again for joining us. Hope you have a great week ahead, and we'll talk to you again soon on the Thirsty Mage. Bye for now.